Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. My favorite segment of the week. Reloading the news. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. Lauren, radio TV personality here in Chicago. She hosts In the Loop at WYCC. Lauren, great to see you.
I like this Cohen and Cohen thing.
It's going to screw me up crazy tonight. Jeff Cohen, of course, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Good to see you, Jeff.
Sir.
All right, so we got a lot to talk about tonight. We reload. Okay, so you know how this works. We've got biggest story. We've got overreported, underreported, winners, losers. What story sucked you down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from? What are they going to put on the caves? They're going to scrawl this story on the cave from this week. That's what we're doing tonight. Like I said, 312-981-7200. Let's get right to the biggest. And I have to say, I mean, we kind of already had tossed the stories around, and just like the news cycle does to us, a late Friday entry into the mix. Jared Kushner and reports that he was trying to create a back channel for secret communications with Russia. This is not a great look for Jared Kushner and the Trump administration right now.
It isn't, but I love the story because it gets sexier by the minute. It's like, where's Tom Clancy? Is he sitting there getting ready to write his next book?
Right, right.
You know, it reminds me, do you guys remember the game Clue? Is it going to be Professor Plum in the library with the candlestick? This story is so awesome and yet not awesome because we have no idea, you know, what really happened and where is the collusion, if there is collusion.
Right.
But it couldn't be a better story for journalists to be watching. And I mean, now that the inner circle is getting, you know, more attention. Oh, and the new information that came out about the FBI director and
James Comey,
James Comey, and what he knew regarding the emails and reportedly not disclosing that, knowing that Russia had, you know, sort of made up that story. I can't keep up, Jeff.
Yeah, it's basically daily at this point. Every day at the end of the day, it's like the New York Times guys and women now. And the Washington Post, likewise, they just wait to see the other crew leave, and then they throw their latest thing up on the internet.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, on the elevator ride down here, I may miss something. So.
Well, I mean, for you, covering this story or just sort of paying attention to the story, what does the Jared Kushner angle, what we found out tonight that he was trying to create a back channel, secret communications, that's the wording in the Washington Post.
Right.
What does that mean? I read the Washington Post analysis that said this is the biggest sort of smoke. You know, this is the most smoke we've seen from this story.
Well,
is it a big deal?
I think it is. It is a big deal one way or the other. There's really only a couple. Well, let's say it's true. It's either the question becomes, why do you want this? You're either very naive and think you can do it, or you are naive about the way the system works, or you actually have something to hide or something to discuss with the Russians that you want to try to avoid any scrutiny on. So I think that's, you know, it's a problem either way, really.
And by the way, Michael Flynn was there too, reportedly. So, you know, there's another link. And what is the arrogance of this family? You know, what is he doing there? Okay, maybe he's talking to a banker, some disguise of they're doing business. We've done business with Russia. I mean, there's such an arrogance about the way this plays out with this family, including the president, who's, you know, making decisions over chocolate cake or, you know, making comments to the, you know, FBI director, am I under investigation? I think this is some narcissism that we're seeing that maybe it goes to Kushner as well, that they're sort of above the law or above protocol.
And I guess the question is protocol, that's a great word. It's not illegal necessarily, but it definitely is the decorum, the protocol, everything involved in how you're supposed to act when you're in the White House is on display.
Well,
here.
And it's a special problem too, because Kushner's so close to the president and has basically been given, you know, a crazy number of responsibilities and jokes about the things that Trump has turned over to Jared Kushner. So I think for me, one interesting thing is going to be, what does Team Trump do with this now? I mean, what's the next play? Can you claim that it's just flat out not true? Can you claim that it was misconstrued? Because if you read into the story, this was discovered by monitoring of this
Russian
being called into Moscow.
Right.
So you could see them saying, well, this is not exactly what Jared was trying to communicate. Maybe they conflated it. Maybe this is an ambassador to the United States trying to impress his boss and come up with a story that makes it sound like, you know, right here at the beginning of the new administration that, you know, I've got a winning play already. So, I mean, can they claim it's false? Kushner doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that they're going to cut. I mean, in a normal circumstance, something in the White House like this in a normal administration, they'd shelve them right away and say, whatever this is, you got to, you know, take a time out. I don't think that happens.
It's, I mean, it's just the story keeps continuing and continuing where, and I guess the question I have, because you hear this, it's now starting to bubble up, that do the American people care? Do the voters who voted for Donald Trump, do they care that there's back channels with Russia? Is this kind of story over everybody's head in a way that it's not, you know, corruption as we know it, it's collusion, it's a different kind of thing. Is this going to have any sort of indelible impact on the Trump administration or how people think of them?
I think it absolutely will for two reasons. I think, though, first to Jeff's point, what you're going to see is optics. They're so good at changing the narrative. I definitely will give whatever you like about his politics, that the president and his team around him are good at changing the narrative. So they'll throw out, you know, Kushner's attorneys on top of this saying he'll talk to anybody, and the FBI's casting a wide net. But to your point, the bigger story is, where are we with Russia? I mean, to me, that's the story of the American people when we're thinking, worrying about Kim Jong-un and missiles in North Korea. What is going on in terms of a second Cold War here? I mean, we have a massive amount of NATO military in the Baltics. The West and Russia are fighting over the Ukraine. And then we've got Russian warplanes and U.S. warplanes over Syria. And now, you know, Trump's going to come out and say, well, we're going to keep the sanctions against Russia. Mm-hmm. What is really going on here?
Yeah, and what is this all about? I mean, why are you reaching out for back channels and secret communication when the allegations are that the Russians helped or colluded in helping to elect President Trump?
Yeah, I mean, you can see them blaming the media again. I mean, everything's the media's fault and liberal America's view of them. So they could maybe come out and say, well, we thought we needed a back channel because the regular channels, we can't just march, you know, the ambassador into the White House. We'll be, you know, pepper sprayed for weeks in the press. We need to come up with something that was a little bit cleaner and free of that kind of influence. I don't know.
I think the American people are interested in this because, you know, his approval rating is very low right now. And I know that we're concerned about domestic issues that are very important, but I think this just has so many legs that, I mean, everyone I talk to seems to be interested in it.
And it's funny, too, you know, this was, I mean, even without the Kushner story that just broke, I mean, that's it's in the circle. It's in the cycle this week, and it made it into our list. Not necessarily the biggest. I mean, this overshadows a terrorist attack in Manchester, which was probably up to this point the biggest story of the week, and so many other stories, even locally with the tax hike. But once again, we are back with Russia, Trump, and this story that just won't go.
Well, we just saw another story on Monday, which now feels like, you know, a month ago. another report that Donald Trump had basically asked some senior intelligence officials to put the clamps down again on the FBI investigation of Russia. I mean, that was this week. It doesn't feel like it.
Well, you knew the John Brennan testimony this week,
yeah,
too.
Right.
I mean, how many more
of these
guys?
It seems like a month and a half ago.
And Flynn took the fifth. I mean, you knew that was going to happen. And so it all looks guilty. There's something going on. It's why? And if there was any type of collusion or anything in terms of rigging to the – this is why Hillary Clinton's out now. Have you noticed that she's come out of the woodwork and she's speaking
out? Well, we'll talk about that. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Why don't we get to the overreported and underreported stories that happened this week here on The Download. Stay with us. All right, so Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. 773 says – the whole Russia story just makes me sick. 219 says, we the people don't believe anything that news media says, making up stories so they can get ratings, fake news. There you go. So we're seeing a contrast in the text tonight. Jeff Cohen and Lauren Cohen in studio as we break down this week's news. So we went up through the biggest story. And like I said, Manchester was definitely our choice. And also some other big stories. So many big stories this week. But obviously the Jared Kushner story that just broke, the Washington Post sort of trumped it. Let's talk about, overreported and underreported. Jeff, your overreported story is one that was all week long, and it was the first overseas trip for President Trump.
Yeah, that was one of mine. And I mean, obviously there's going to be reporting on the president's first overseas trip, especially when Trump really hasn't traveled very much at all. I mean, even west of the Mississippi, right. I think you can maybe count on your hand, but, yeah, basically, I think that could be a Twitter problem, too. I mean, we get so much of our news these days from social media, obviously, but just every little, I mean, Melania won't hold his hand, and he's pushing a guy out of the way, and, you know, the weird...
that was a great moment, though.
Like, the weird sort of Adams family photo with the Pope, and it just felt like, after a while, it's like every 5 seconds, I felt like I was just seeing another weird thing versus anybody really talking about whatever policy.
Well, and I agree. I have to say, I mean, there was so much, I guess, there was just so much reporting that was about how he was relating or reacting or in the moment with world leaders. It wasn't necessarily about what they were talking about or what the policies were that was coming up beyond. I mean, last week was a Saudi Arabia speech at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, that was like, I think that was over the weekend where it started. And that was the rest of it has been when he was in Israel and he said, we just got back from the Middle East. And the ambassador on and he grabs his head and then he realizes he's on tape and he's like, I'm going to rub my hair. Yeah. I thought a very strange and head scratching moment at NATO where the speech was, I really don't like NATO to NATO. I mean, it's just.
And yeah. I don't like Germany to Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought the funny one was when he pushed aside the leader and pushed in front for the photo op. But then if you looked at the aerials, that he was walking through the crowd of dignitaries and looking up and waving more than anybody else was, like he was some rock star, like he was Sting in the crowd and everybody was suddenly like there to see him. But there's no context in what he does and what he says. So regardless of your politics and what you think of the president, I don't feel like there was so much for reporters to even report on because he doesn't have any information or context when he visits this country. It's all a photo op.
It was much more about the circus, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the other thing is leaders of other countries and their reactions to him. And we haven't really seen a lot of that in person, you know, sort of on their home turf. So I guess that part of it was interesting. But
the other overreported story you had, which I want to bring up so we can get to the underreported stories Lauren has as well. The census, the population story. I agree. This is a local story, and it's about how Chicago is shrinking, and there's all this. And now that comes out, the U-Haul comes back, says a lot of people are using our trucks to move to Chicago. I mean, it's a goofy story.
I just felt that most of the time it was reported without context, and we've been dealing with a situation here for a number of years where, you know, you hear the term tale of two cities, and I think that's probably what we have here. We have in the last official census of 2010, we learned that some 200,000 African Americans had left Chicago and the Chicago area, and immigration from, you know, Mexico and some other things had kind of offset that. The other thing that's offset it is sort of the kind of the global city we see growing around us downtown. We have cranes everywhere. We have, you know, McDonald's headquarters coming to the West Loop. You've got a lot of young kids just out of college coming here. And so it almost is it's a balance. I mean, to talk about several thousand mm-hmm. people even being down, you don't really have the kind of the back and forth of what's really going on here. You have some of the lower income impoverished areas that are dealing with crime and a lot of social problems. They're really emptying out and you're kind of getting a swap for, you know, younger, non-minority, wealthier Chicagoans. And I just felt like it was just, oh, look, Chicago's turning into Detroit. Well, no, it isn't.
Well, I mean, it seems like whenever there's any sort of shift, even if it's hundreds instead of thousands of people that leave Chicago, it seems to become a story that makes it in the headlines and in our Twitter feeds and other places. Why do you think that is? I mean, there seems to be almost a schadenfreude at work here where people want to see the city fail. And if people are leaving, it confirms that.
Because people need something to complain about. And in this case, the massive migration out is related to the fact that it's becoming unaffordable to live. It's the whole property tax issue that everybody's freaking out about. And it's become a bigger narrative because of the budget impasse and what's going on. And whether they're liberal or conservative talking points or Republican or Democratic talking points, you know, you're going to see these headlines about all these people are leaving because you can't afford your home anymore. We're going to go talk about health insurance, or the cost of living has gone up. The median household income is $57,000, you know, dollars. That hasn't changed since 2007. Mm-hmm. So you might see more high rises going up in downtown, and certain, you know, millennials may or may not be able to afford them. But you still have people leaving because our neighbors have better offers for manufacturing.
And we still became a target. I mean, not to keep going back to Trump, but he dragged Chicago into the spotlight repeatedly a few months ago, you know, dealing with the violence issue and whatnot. So I think there's still a lot of energy toward anything negative in Chicago kind of is blown back to the Obama situation.
Yeah, and I mean, as much as there's optics are a big part of this and obviously bad tweets, things of that nature, there are a lot of problems in this town. And if you're on the fringe and you have the ability to leave, I can understand why people might want to jet.
I have friends that have left because of that reason. They're just like, it's too much already. Are there opportunities? Maybe there are some in certain sectors, like we've built our tech community up. But in other areas where you may not have the skill set, or you're a company, I mean, I did a piece for PBS on all these manufacturing companies that said, you know what, we're going to move, you know, right from East Chicago over to Indiana where we don't have to move that far because it's mm-hmm. a better deal for us. Mm-hmm. And it's more affordable to live there.
And if you're in one of these communities where you can't walk to the corner store without hearing gunshots and worrying about where your kid is, then, you know, I'd leave too the second I could. And I think that, you know, people use that to reflect badly on the mayor, you know, and that's probably a natural.
Jeff Cohen, Lauren Cohn, in studio tonight as we reload this week's news. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news from Rob. We come back underreported. Great start. Thinking of all the news that's happened this week, we haven't even got to Springfield with what's happening with the last week of what might be a balanced budget. We'll see. We haven't talked at all about the healthcare situation, the vote and the Congressional Budget Office. We haven't even talked about the Montana guy who slammed the reporter yet. There's a lot going on.
We're going to need maybe 3 hours.
We're going to need a couple more hours here as we reload the news here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Excited to have my panel in studio tonight, Lauren Cohn. She's a radio TV personality. She hosts In Loop at WYCC, co-hosts that show. Jeff Cohen, of course, investigative reporter, Chicago Tribune. You read his byline every year and a half or so.
You know, you're being a little optimistic there.
All right, let's keep going. Underreported.
I read what you write.
Yeah. Underreported. So we did overreported. Underreported. I have to say, Lauren, you're underreported. Just hit it right on the head. The idea of the Congressional Budget Office brings out the numbers on what this new healthcare bill is going to cost American taxpayers. And 23 million people are going to get bounced off insurance in 10 years. And it just kind of, it was a headline for a minute, but there was a lot more to what the CBO was saying, and we just, no one grabbed it.
There's so much to this story. I mean, the headline was, oh, 23 million people are going to lose their insurance. I'm not sure that the CBO numbers are correct, because they originally said that, you know, double the amount of people were going to sign up for Obamacare, and they didn't.
Right.
So, but even if it is correct, and that's the headline, and you feel empathetic towards those people who had access to health insurance, there's so many layers to the story that we forget. We forget to go back to the fact that there were so many taxpayers, people who had health insurance plans that they liked, doctors that they liked, that they lost. They lost their doctors. Cancer patients who then were facing mortgage-style payments for health care. So, and on top of this, nobody's talking about the exchanges. You know, they can go back and forth between the House and the Senate all summer into the, you know, the fall over what to do and pick apart now Trump Care.
Right.
But it really doesn't matter because insurers are setting the rate for June, and they're going to set that could get extended to August. So mm-hmm. whatever's going to be set for 2018 is going to be a lot of money out of everybody's pocket.
The problem I have with everything that you said, which is spot on, is that this bill doesn't change any of that. For all the things that happened and that the Republicans wanted to fix with the bill when there was criticism to the Obama plan, you getting bumped off your plan, doctors, all that kind of stuff, that's not even really touched in this, and it's going to continue. And what you find more often now is just, I think the CBO said, a predicted 20% increase in premiums for everybody, not just for people who are on the exchanges, but for everybody, for me at my work, other places, you know, the idea that healthcare insurance is going to go up. I'm just fascinated on how that story became political.
It's
in the way that
too.
CBO is like, Republicans throw it out because of its bad track record when it comes to predictions.
But in a week like we're talking about, it's just bizarre that the eighth or ninth Trump story is the fact that he's leaning toward basically sabotaging the existing system.
Yeah.
And defunding. I mean, that's completely lost in the shuffle beyond, you know, Russia and everything else and the Pope and whatnot.
Well, and you go back to the fact that, okay, so what in terms of what the Republicans like in the plans, they like the tax incentives. They want to stop the mandate. They don't want you to be forced to buy health care. So there are things in there. What they're doing is they're picking this apart financially, basically, Justin, because they don't know how to pick this thing apart. You know, they ran on repeal and replace because it was unpopular for their base, and it's unpopular for a lot of people. I've never been a fan of it because if you're going to roll out something like that, you better have a plan to pay for it, and you can't just put the burden on taxpayers to foot the bill for other folks if they're going to then lose their health insurance. It's if you're going to redistribute wealth, there has to be a better system. And some people thought, you know, President Obama was teeing us up for single payer. I don't personally think that the government should be in the business of healthcare because they didn't do a very good job.
No.
But what the Republicans are doing right now is they're sort of trying to pick this apart because they don't know what to do.
They don't really have anywhere to go. And I think, I mean, even Boehner today, I think, came out and said it's pretty much dead as far as he's concerned in the Senate?
Well, I'm concerned only because I think about this a lot, and we've had conversations even on the download this week about other areas where the federal government has been accused of overreaching. And we talked about it with the Fraternal Order of Police president. We talked about it with Laura Kipnis about sexual assaults on campuses. There seemed to be a thread that the government may have in their best interest, to the best interest of Americans and American taxpayers, you know, having universal health care, it might be that. But the way that they implement it, and it doesn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat or who's in charge, implementing a federal program, almost they always get it wrong. There's something about that it's just not, and there's something to be said, and I know that this, that and I don't think it's articulated very well for President Trump, but I think that's what he means when he said the federal government shouldn't be in this and shouldn't be in that. That's what he's saying. It's like, it's too big, it's too unwieldy, it's not actually going to work for people. Just get out of that game.
Right, and that's why he's saying too many moving parts, like, you know, leave Medicare alone, leave Social Security alone, and then kick it back to the states. So let the states try and handle this. Let them handle, you know, if those that expanded Medicaid, and that's become a real issue. That's another thing that sort of gets buried is the whole weeds of Medicaid, and it was originally set up to help the people that need it the most. Now there are all these layers of people getting Medicaid, as opposed to the conversation of these people need to be getting jobs to be out there and be working and to be able to afford health care. The other thing that nobody talks about is whatever happened to the idea of competition and free market, right? Insurers are in the business of giving you skinny light at the most amount of money. But if you have a system where there's choice, where there's competition, you drive prices down.
Yeah, but we'd had that, though. We had that 8 years ago before Obamacare came in, the idea that we relied on the free market and competition to drive insurances. And we saw egregious, just draconian and inhumane things happening in the free market. So there was a reason why the government came in to say we have to have federal universal health care for all because the insurance companies are run amok. So there's I understand why they would do it. I question at the end of the day what we're doing now that's different than what was done 5 years ago, 8 years ago, or whatever, you know, when you talk about federal health care.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's one of the most difficult issues going right now. And I've been fortunate enough to have a fairly long Tribune career, and I've had good health insurance pretty much throughout. And I kind of agree with you. I'm kind of afraid of a system going back to where, you know, the insurance companies really are running.
Let me ask you this, Lauren, because you said it too, this idea that pushing it back to the states. And this has been something that has been a big, big part of the Trump administration's push to how he wants to run the federal government. And he ran on this concept, too, to take the federal government's hands out of a lot and put it back to the states. But we live in a state where we don't have a balanced budget. We don't have any disposable income. There's no bank accounts. You know, it's like we don't have rainy day funds. So if you're pushing back to the states a Medicaid expansion or any sort of social service cuts or social service agencies or any sort of help, the state's going to say no. We're not going to do that because we can't afford it.
Well, then it's up to the governors, and the governors are going to decide whether Republicans or Democrats. So you might see something here in this state. You know, the whole idea of okay, well, if we're going to be a state, we're going to opt out of the exchanges. We're going to, you know, Governor Rauner wants to completely revamp Medicaid. Here's what's interesting about the exchanges. You two have kept your health care. I've experienced losing my health care and then having to, okay, as an individual, you have to go to the exchange. You can't go directly to, let's say, an Aetna or Blue Cross Blue Shield. So when you go to the exchanges, what happened here in Illinois, which has happened across the country, is you had a number of PPOs and HMOs in the exchanges. And we'd read the headlines in the Tribune all the time. Mm-hmm. Okay, Northwestern's dropping out. Now Blue Cross Blue Shield is dropping out with the Northwestern plan. Now let's go to Land of Lincoln. But they didn't make it. So we'll kick everybody to Harkin. Now Harkin's out, right? So we kept seeing that. Currently now in the exchange in Illinois, you have HMOs and you have one PPO, Blue Cross Blue Shield, but a lot of doctors at Northwestern and other places aren't in it.
It's ridiculous.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
So what do you do? So then when I went to the exchange, it was more expensive than COBRA. And by the way, COBRA, which is an extension of your health insurance for 18 months, if folks out there don't know what it is, it's very expensive. So I now saw my monthly payment go up sixfold.
Yeah, that's not how it's supposed to go, right?
Right, and then a higher deductible, and it's a mortgage payment.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. Everything that you said is the reason why Obamacare is failing and has failed. Now, the question I have for you, as someone who's on it, do you blame the federal government? Do you blame the insurance companies who have decided that they're going to opt out because it's not worth, they're not making enough money on those plans? I mean, that's where it starts to get weird for me, where I'm like, Well, the system is designed for the healthcare companies or the insurance companies to come in and say, all right, we'll do this. And at some point or another, they said, we're not making enough money on this deal, so we're going to bounce out. And once they bounced out, then you started to see some of the problems you were just talking about.
Well, so I don't believe in government handouts. So from my own perspective, working as a hardworking person and I pay taxes, I want to be out there and I want to have choice. So I don't want to be told I have to go to the exchange. I don't necessarily want to be told either if I'm going to get the opportunity, hopefully, to go to a Blue Cross Blue Shield or an Aetna or a Cigna, to be told if I have a pre-existing condition, which I do, I have a thyroid condition, suddenly you can't be on it. So this is new for me, and it's going to be really interesting. But I believe that I should be able to shop around, find the best plan for me. And by the way, insurers are going to offer skinny light for the most amount of money because they can, because there's nothing to drive them, their costs down. In terms of, you know, I would rather that than deal with the government personally.
Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen in studio. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll do winners and losers. It's a download. Stay with us. All right, we're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Mike on the line. Mike, what do you want to say about insurance companies?
Hey, I just want to hear more about your comment that talked about how draconian and I forget the other adjective you used, that insurance companies were pre-Obamacare. And that just really kind of catches me off guard. I really think that the insurance companies are part of the solution. Not part of the
Mike,
problem.
What I mean, but and the reason there was a federal a mandate, if you will, I mean, to bring universal health care to America was because there were thoughts that the private insurance market, everything that was happening before 2008, was run amok. You don't agree with that?
I do not.
Okay.
I actually 100% disagree with it. That's what the people said, or the politicians said. The problem is that healthcare and the cost of healthcare, meaning inflation in healthcare, is way out of control.
Yeah.
And that's not the insurance companies. That has nothing to do with the insurance companies. That has to do with doctors, hospitals, pharmacies, labs. The insurance companies are like two pennies in the overall scheme of things. So I actually find it sort of irresponsible journalism for you to say that.
I thank you for calling me a journalist. I appreciate it.
I don't know. Well, you, whatever. I like your show sincerely, and I like your comments. But like, tell me the bad things they did.
Well, can I just make a point? And that is what's interesting, Mike. In terms of what Mike is bringing up is that in terms of the rates of doctors and the rates of big pharma, those are things that do need to be renegotiated. You shouldn't be able to, you know, have a $20,000 procedure in Alabama and it'd be $40,000 here. So there is a lot of discrepancies in terms of rates, but there's also for doctors reimbursements that they're not getting. There's also, you know, when you go in to a hospital or you go in for your annual checkup, do you actually ask the question when the doctor says, I'm going to do your blood work, what are you doing and how much is it cost at the lab?
Right. You don't ever.
And now you have to, because when you get that bill, there's got to be a new education of what your doctor's asking and suggesting that you get. But also you have to be vigilant as a consumer to not rack up all these costs when you go for unnecessary treatments.
And it's never been in the consumer's interest or it's never been told to a consumer to monitor the things that are happening with your doctor prescribes.
And I also think what he's sort of referring to in terms of insurance is I think when Obamacare was rolled out, it was really a redistribution of wealth. And I think that that's why the whole idea was really teeing it up for single payer. I think that this is sort of what President Obama did for 8 years, and he really wanted to redistribute the wealth in this country. But what happened was there were not enough people that signed up for Obamacare, and it then became, you know, too expensive for the government, for the taxpayers to subsidize. And the insurers had a caveat in there that if this starts to implode, you still have to give us money, which is what's being argued in court right now. And they just got the 90-day extension that the federal government still has to keep giving the insurance companies a portion of that money.
Well, I don't necessarily agree that it was redistribution of wealth. I mean, I think that the idea that we wanted federal health care, universal health care, was something that was ran on by the politicians in that campaign. The idea that it's high time for do that. I understand what Mike's saying about just kind of throwing out generalities, and I understand that. But there was a fervor in 2007, 2008, where people were like, this is going to be the time. I mean, Mitt Romney in Massachusetts was doing it as a governor. It was not a partisan thing. There's this idea that government should be involved in healthcare, and that's what happened. I'm not sure how much it was all about Obama.
And your word partisan there, I think, is one that's well taken, because I think, you know, the American people are pretty well fed up at this point and want these guys to get together and actually compromise.
And by the way, none of them had to take Obamacare, right? None of them.
They fixed that. Yeah, right.
But
this
should be something where we sit down and actually fix this problem.
Yeah, right.
This should not be
political
and counting.
And I think
you're
going to have a tsunami and an implosion before it ever gets to that level.
Well, I mean, that, like I said, I mean, I'm holding an article right here out of North Carolina where now there's only Blue Cross and Blue Shield left down there as far as in the exchange there.
And it gets political, and it gets in this strange moment where you hear the president, you know, sort of hinting at the idea that he wants to kill, he wants to almost kill the exchanges and end this so that the government, the House and the Senate have to act.
I don't think this is one where you can force the issue by doing that to bring people to the table, because it's just not going to work. So it would be a shame to really roll a hand grenade, you know, into the healthcare system to force some kind of a deal.
And by the way, another reason why the CBO numbers may not be correct is the fact that a lot of people were forced to get health care because of the mandate. And so people, you know, may not want to pay that. And therefore, you're going to see those numbers change. That's another underreporting.
Yeah. All right. Let's do winners and losers. Jeff, what do you got for winners this week?
Well, I was going to do the mayor of New Orleans and his speech on the removal of Confederate monuments. I think that was a speech that was widely shared. A lot of people were interested in that. I was going to say the Pope. I think, you know, everybody loves the Pope. I'm going to go with journalism, though. I think, especially with our, you know, at the top of the show here, we started talking about the Washington Post and New York Times. I mean, it's turned into a new golden age for journalism, and you know, a lot of papers are seeing their numbers go up as people are trying to keep, you know, pace with all this stuff, and I just think it's really an interesting.
And you saw even locally some places saying they're going to double their production locally, so there's a lot that's happening. True. What do you got for winners, Lauren?
So winners were the insurance companies, now mm-hmm. back to the, and losers were everybody else. And then when it comes to the, you know, Illinois tax hike, which I know we're going to talk about, of course the winner to me is Speaker Madigan and his, what I call his posse, and the losers are, again, everybody else.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, and I know that Speaker Madigan is the leader of the Democratic Party, and I get it. But he hasn't even touched this yet. I mean, this was Senator Cullerton. This was the Senate. The idea that Mike Madigan's name is stamped on it before the bill even gets to the House.
He's the boss of Illinois.
I understand,
he controls everything.
I get it, but it's just...
He sent us off the fiscal cliff.
I just feel like sometimes the idea of Madigan controlling the strings, I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to have plenty of time this weekend that we see Mike Madigan, and Mike Madigan being up in front when he makes little tweaks to the bills that will end up on Rauner's desk. But so far, I'm not sure Mike Madigan has any play with Christine Rodonio and Senator Cullerton in the other chamber. But maybe I'm naive.
They're little puppets. He's pulling the strings. That's, you know, I know that's a Cassieism, and if John Cass is out there listening, he knows that when I saw this tax story, I said, is the Hobbit hole ready for me to build on your property? Because that's where I'm headed.
I mean, it is and it's too big for us to get into right before the news, and we'll do it right after, but a huge week when it comes to what might we see with a balanced budget and a tax increase, a huge tax increase in the state of Illinois, one that is not just sort of like, well, all right. I mean, some have estimated that, you know, because it would be retroactive to January 1st, it could be hundreds of dollars a month more than it was. All to cover a budget hole and bills that have been stacking up and piling up here in the state of Illinois for the last couple of weeks. So we'll talk. Let's do this. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll do losers, because I think that's really where we can get into who are the losers when it comes to tax hikes and other things. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Lauren Cohen, radio TV personality here in town and the co-host of In the Loop on WYCC. Great show. Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Great paper. Love both. I love what you both do. Okay. Get that out of the way. We did winners. Let's do losers.
Thank you.
We got losers. We got rabbit hole. And we got which story is going to be remembered in 10, 15, 50, 500 years from now. Let's do losers. I mean, I guess, Jeff, we got to start with the Montana congressman. I mean, that's such a story.
Yeah, here we go. I mean, we're way more than an hour in and a journalist getting body slammed. We're just getting to it. So that's interesting.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. I mean, how about that? And then he wins anyway. I mean, it says a lot about sort of our.
Does it? I mean, I was wondering. A friend of mine had a Facebook post, and he really eloquently put it down. He said, "If you are a Republican in Montana, and you are upset with the way that a Republican candidate body slammed a reporter, you're not going to vote for a D. R does not equal D, and D does not equal R. That's a country we live in. We saw that with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You're just not, I mean, so exactly many people, right. Republicans said, I don't really like Donald Trump, but there's no other choice. The same kind of concept here. I think that you're not seeing a political landscape where the alternative in a two-party system is okay for the voter. They're not going to cross parties.
Well, when Speaker Ryan was asked about this, he just said, well, you know, the voters made the decision. He didn't even want to touch it.
No.
And in this case, I mean, you know, he apologized. You know, he gave the big apology, which a lot of them don't necessarily do. He gave an apology.
After the original statement, right. They made it sound like there was a little bit of a wrestling match and they both fell over or something.
Yeah.
As opposed to body slamming, right, punching the guy, breaking his glasses.
As opposed to grabbing him by the neck and throwing him down and then punching him.
I mean, not a good moment for, as we continue to see American politics sort of slide further and further down, this just got the slide greased up.
Didn't you even say that some of the Fox News reporters were afraid at that moment? Or you?
Yeah, well, there was a Fox News crew that was in the room, and that's when the dam sort of broke on it, is when they were out saying that they saw more of a body slamming incident. That's when, you know, finally the thing.
I'm surprised people didn't have their cell phones up and everybody was taking video.
It was a closed door kind of thing, right? They were setting up, like the Fox News people were setting up and they were going to interview him, and a reporter came up to him, and it all happened with only like four or five people.
And he was asking about the CBO numbers, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, right. I mean, that's the other thing is the story that he had reported previously was this candidate's investment ties to Russia. So right back to one.
All right, let's go local here. I mean, that of course is a big loser story of the week for all of us. But the other story that Lauren you have on losers is the tax hike and what's happening in Springfield as the lawmakers here in this state try to balance a budget for the first time in 700 days.
Yeah, I mean, Speaker Madigan's the winner. We're the losers in all of this. This, to me, is outrageous what's going on. I mean, this is tax our way out of our problems, Illinois. You know, this is all that we know how to do. So now we're going to tax the air that we breathe. I mean, what isn't being taxed? I mean, I purposely protest the 7-cent bag tax, or what, that's for paper bags. Maybe it's more for plastic, out of principle. It's just, it's outrageous to me that we have to go line by line and tax everything to find a way for a revenue source. It's practically criminal, in my opinion.
And, but, I mean, what are the alternatives at this point? You're talking 700 days without a budget. What can, I mean, and people will tell you, and nonpartisan, bipartisan people will say that Illinois spending, when it comes to the size of the government for this state, it's not out of proportion. So we just don't bring enough money in. The job of revenue sources, of course, can be shared. The blame can be shared with the legislature, can be shared with the governor, who was a pro-business governor who came in. But at what point does it become irresponsible to not increase taxes?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about bringing in revenue sources, we want to bring in business. We have to change the tax code here to make it more business friendly. But you need pension reform. And here's the thing about pension reform. And, you know, I totally appreciate the fact that people that receive pensions want what was promised to them. But these were deals that were made between union bosses and politicians at a time when the economy was at a different level. And now the amount to pay into these pensions isn't sustainable. And by the way, you can't send the taxpayers below the poverty line to make these pension payments. We're talking about maybe 5% of the population versus 95% who are paying for it. And so the problem is that until you fix the math, because it's not sustainable for them either. The pensioners are not going to get it because the math doesn't add up. So you have to have pension reform. You have to have them come together. Governor Rauner successfully negotiated with close to a dozen unions, including the Teamsters. There's got to be something that can be done there.
Yeah, but the big ones, AFSCME and others, he's still out on. But I will say that, you know, and Jeff, I want to bring you in on this. I mean, this has been a political hot potato on what happens. And we talk about the politics of passing a tax hike. And we saw, I mean, the thing I think for taxpayers to remember, too, is that there was this income tax was, we had a higher income tax, and the governor let it freeze, or he let it expire back in when he took office. And then we've had two or three years of this fight over budgets and ideology, and we're back to the point where we could be in 3 days back to the same idea of having the same rate.
And to me, it goes back too to what you said about just the political environment. I mean, we don't have anything like sort of the old school statesmanship compromise. Rana was sent down there to engage in trench warfare that looks just like this, and neither side's willing to give. And I know we talked on the break about, you know, sort of this last minute attempt at a balanced budget and to get something to Rana. But, you know, is that another political fake out, you know, to force him to veto something that includes a balanced budget so that, you know, he's a weaker candidate?
Mike Madigan
is definitely playing chess.
This is political chess, because there are four players in that, and there are more, but I would say in this scenario, you have Christine Redonio and John Cullerton in the Senate. John Cullerton steps up and says, we're not going to do the grand bargain stuff. This has been a ruse. I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to pass a tax hike. The Senate does that. It's now in Madigan's hand. We don't know what he's going to do with it. He's been tight-lipped. Does he pass it through to give it to Rauner? So Rauner has to make a decision of whether or not he accepts a tax hike and signs it and has a balanced budget, or veto it, like Jeff said.
But the governor has said that he's willing to agree to some tax hikes for one thing on his so-called turnaround agenda. Give him one thing.
Right.
I mean, come on, guys. Give him one thing. I mean, this is what it's been going back and forth. That giving at least term limits. You know, I asked him in an interview once. I sat down with him for 15 minutes at one of his manufacturing plants, and we aired this on PBS. What's the one thing if you could get? And it was term limits. And I think that's obviously a shot at, you know, Speaker Madigan, who's been there. But even when under Governor Quinn, when we had the tax hike going back to 2011, we still went off the fiscal cliff. So you can't just keep raising taxes and thinking it's going to fix the problem.
No, I understand that. But this time around, I mean, Rauner has a chance to claim victory here. In the way, it's a win for him. I put him in the winner category in the way that he could sign this and say, when I took over, government was this high. And I have, through the 2.5 years of stalemate, brought spending back into form. The size of government is smaller than it was. We are getting closer and closer to understand. I mean, the some of the things that were in the balanced budget, the 10% tax or 10% cuts at universities, 5% cuts at social service agencies, that would never have been done by Democrats if it wasn't for the pressure that Rauner put on.
Well, and how about him turning back to basically campaign style ads to get his point across here? He's put the flannel shirt back on.
The duct tape?
Yeah.
the MacGyver look.
Right. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think that, you know, the jeopardy goes way up for him if they get this thing to his desk.
It is. And I just wonder, I don't know if I have the mental political capability to wonder what the machinations are happening right now of what the right call is for a speaker, a Democrat speaker and a Republican governor, because this is all about what happens in 2018. And you're right. The losers here are us. Because we've been losers for 700 days without a budget, and so many of our fellow taxpayers are feeling the pinch, and we're going to and several more, all of us are going to feel it if this gets through. But man, it's what a story.
You want to almost see a movement here in Illinois of people marching to Springfield and saying we've had enough is enough. You know, we've had enough of this, and you need to come together. But Governor Rauner does hold the highest office. It's his responsibility to bring both sides together. And I support that he came in as a businessman, and he's trying. This is what he was elected to do, to bring the fiscal house in order. And I think that there needs to be a corrective in Springfield. So give him one thing that he wants, get this thing done, and let's move forward.
Yeah, it's so good. And it all happened here in the next 5 days, right?
Yeah, Wednesday's the last day.
Because if they go past Wednesday, if it doesn't happen by Wednesday, you go to that supermajority, that 71 votes. They don't have it.
I think it's basically Wednesday or not.
I don't think it's going to happen because I don't think Speaker Madigan wants to. He has no reason to negotiate. He has no incentive. So I think it's just going to.
But I love this because it's like, if he lets it die, then the Republicans have, and the commercials and everything that's going to come out, and their campaign can be like, he's the one that did not want to have a balanced budget. I mean, I don't know what he does. It's a rock and a hard place for all of them, and it's, you know, the best politics happens at the last minute. So we'll see how this kind of plays out. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen, in studio right now. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do rabbit hole stories, and we'll find out which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news. Lauren Cohn in studio, radio TV personality. Catch her, she's the co-host of In the Loop on WYCC. As I know, Channel 20. Does it even work back then anymore? Is it 20 still?
It's still 20.
Is it? I love it. Jeff Cohn, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Lauren just mentioned in the break, wow, it has been a very heavy week in review.
Yeah.
We have not. There's not been a lot of like, you know, this light story. Where's the man romper?
What color is his dress?
The dad that wore a Speedo when he ran into school to see the kid. Did you see that video? Yeah. And it was a flashback to everything our parents have ever done that has embarrassed us. This poor kid, to designate it's the last day of summer, dad has to run up in a Speedo. And he just was not the kind of guy who should be running in a Speedo.
I'm thankful I did not catch that.
You're right. It's nice to see some stuff on the internet that's not Trump-related. It's not gaffes and things like that. So that's always nice. All right, so let's talk about Rabbit Hole. Jeff, you've got a story that you were reading out of L.A. that caught your fancy.
Yeah, this is not really going to lighten the mood, but this is when I did catch kind of randomly. It ran in Newsweek, apparently, but I saw it online. By Alexander Nazarian is the reporter's name, and it's the art washing of America, the battle for the soul of Los Angeles against gentrification. And basically the point of the story tracks activists in L.A., East L.A., fighting art galleries coming into their neighborhood. They see that as sort of the knife point of gentrification and the start of the coffee shops and the bacon cocktails and all that stuff. And they think that if they fight the galleries that they'll be able to kind of, you know, keep this at bay. And it just reminded me of some of the things we've seen in Chicago neighborhoods, Humboldt Park and things, as people get priced out of Wicker Park and some of these other places, you know, that's where they tend to go. So is the art gallery the bellwether? So I thought that was interesting.
And usually, I mean, we think of art gallery and you might have this hoity-toity kind of, even in Chicago and the River North or West Loop, but a lot of art galleries, they're not. They're artists from the community, they're local, that they open up a space in a storefront, and you don't necessarily automatically think that to be a precursor to gentrification.
You wouldn't. And even some of the art galleries that have come into these areas, at least in the story, you know, really did highlight people in the local community. But for whatever reason, the activists have seized on this. I just thought it was interesting, and it led me to, you know, reading about Dodger Stadium and how this is kind of history repeating itself. I didn't realize that Chavez Ravine actually had been a Mexican neighborhood that was kind of emptied out, and there were hills leveled up there to get the stadium in. It was sort of the definition of a rabbit hole for me. It was like 2 hours later.
Interesting.
It's like the fear of the hoity-toity, and it can't just be, it would create business and opportunity for those. It's this, you know, when people are so tight in their community and live in one way and not open to others, it's kind of amazing to think of that in 2017.
But you understand too, like if you're looking for a knife point of gentrification that it used to, I know that. I mean, Wicker Park, it was the guitar players, the street performers, even where you're like, oh, this is, and it was art galleries. Well, it's art galleries where you're like, oh, this is cute. This brings so much life to the neighborhood.
Yeah. They make the point of if you wait for the Starbucks to appear, you've lost, you know, you're already, the battle's over at that point.
And at the same time, you see it on the other hand, where you're like, an art gallery can be a center point for a community. It can be a place that showcases the artists and the work that's being done in a certain neighborhood without changing its feel.
Yeah, they'd rather keep it the way it is and not get priced out.
Yeah. Love it. All right. That's a good wrap. Where is that at? Newsweek?
Newsweek, the art washing of America.
I'm going to check that out. All right, so let's do this, guy. You guys ready for the end here?
Absolutely.
Which story from this week will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week? Lauren, what do we think is going to be the story?
The top story is going to be Manchester. It has to be. I mean, it rocked everybody to the core. It was just a horrific scene. And to see it in this case, you know, the bomb going off right outside the Ariana Grande concert with children, you know, mothers standing there with their children. 22 people were killed. I think 10 of those were children, you know. Just heartbreaking. And it resurfaces, obviously, the story of terrorism and what you need to watch out for. You know, the conversation of how vigilant do we need to be, that, you know, after 9/11, it was the first on American soil. Then the Boston bombing. We're seeing this now all over Europe. That brings up the conversation again of, you know, visas. If someone's going to travel back and forth, they are born in the UK, but they're going to travel back to Libya or other countries. Do we let them back in? Raises that whole conversation.
Yeah, it does
again.
Get back into immigration and everything. As ISIS splinters and we do sort of defeat them in terms of their land area space they occupy, where do those fighters go? And, you know, more and more we're seeing them kind of try to reintegrate back into Europe and
And I thought really interesting story about that the mosque in Manchester had reported this guy.
Mm-hmm, right.
And told everybody, authorities, government authorities, police, everything, and nothing was done. So I think that also brings up the question of what is being done by governments and our police forces to make sure that when communities are reporting that they have an issue, that it's being taken care of. That's interesting.
When you talk to Homeland Security directors here, you know, whether it's Cook County or whether it's, you know, statewide, you know, national, they'll tell you about all the stories of thwarting these types of attacks. Yeah. Everything has gotten a lot better since 9/11, but you can't stop lone wolves. You can't, you know, if people are, you know, radicalized by ISIS via email, you can't stop it.
Well, that's the thing here, too, is that so many, ISIS realized sort of that the cards were against them. And so a lot of these training videos have just sort of seeped out. I mean, how to make a bomb, go to Walmart and buy things to make a bomb. And then, like you said, one lone wolf who's got an ideological string that goes awry, next thing you know, you've got one of these.
And it reminds these governments and different bodies that they have to share information, mm-hmm. you know, that if you have somebody on a watch list, that you should share that, if UK with the United States. Governments have to work better together.
The other story this week was much different and much lighter, and Lauren, you had it in his mind as well, was the passing of the torch, if you will, as LeBron James beat Michael Jordan when it came to points scored in the playoffs. And as we get ready with a very long amount, a lot of time before the NBA finals start, they start on next Thursday, June 1st, the idea that LeBron James and Michael Jordan, is there a changing of the guard?
Well, I think in LeBron James's, this is what he's been rooting for, and Michael Jordan's his idol, but he, you know, was so excited, some would say, or arrogant, was running down the court with his index finger in the air as number one. I mean, it's almost like this is what he's wanted all along, and he got it.
Yeah, it's kind of the nature of the NBA, too. I think more than any other sport, it's about the individual athlete. I mean, you don't really see it. I mean, you've got the Tom Brady's and whatnot, but the NBA, it's sort of maximized. And you have the greatest player who's ever played is Michael Jordan. You have somebody who's finally reaching some of these levels. I think it's natural. And I think it was Bernie Lindscombe's column today or yesterday talking about, you know, yes, LeBron is back, you know, facing the Warriors again, but really he's playing Michael Jordan. And that's true.
Yeah. Talk about the pressure.
Yeah.
Guys, not only got to have to play the four all-world players on the Golden State Warriors, but he's also got to play Michael Jordan, too.
Right.
Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen, you guys, great job reloading this week's news. It was awesome to have you, and I can't wait to have you again. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.